G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Adam White is ready to go for another big morning of Sports Talk Radio. Good morning to you, Whitey.
Good morning, Daniel. Just confirming the date.
Yeah, 1st September. You know what? I've got Jock's Journal open. I've got the journal open, right? We have this thing that tells you what happens on this day and all that sort of stuff. And it's actually open on the page because I'm prepared. On Tuesday, the 1st of September. But when I went to say the 1st of September, I thought, today's Monday. It's not Tuesday. Even though I'd opened the show by saying it was Tuesday. So there you go. That's the sort of world I'm living in at the moment, Adam White. That's my world.
I genuinely feared for Joey there for a moment that he put the wrong date up on the screen.
Oh, well, that's awful. He hadn't. Anyway. No, it is he the 1st of September. I can tell you that straight up.
Yes,
so I opened the show saying it's Tuesday. I actually thought it was Monday when I read Tuesday and said it was Monday. I'm going beautifully.
So we've got a situation that under normal circumstances of this Tuesday, we're only 2 days away from the first final being held.
What?
And that's not happening. Well, if this was a normal year, on Thursday night would be the first final. But we've still got 4 rounds of footy to go.
Yes. Well, but considering we lost, what did we lose? 12 weeks through the season.
Yeah, about that, yeah.
Was it 12 weeks?
So they've done quite well to sort of get themselves almost back. Yeah, we have. We've made up a lot. I was surprised, I must confess, when I was told yesterday that there were 2 games of AFL football to be played tonight, but there was none last night.
Oh, bless you.
I've got some hay fever issues.
Oh, no, you got the virus.
No, I'm fine. I'm fine. I might be a bit lethargic to start today because for the 87th time, maybe 88th time, I started a diet yesterday. And
it's got a hold of you already.
I'm back on the, I've gone the 5-2, which I know you don't like me doing.
You love the 5-2.
Well, it works. So, and my walking didn't work because I did 100,000 steps for 5 weeks in a row and I didn't lose any weight. And it was a soul-destroying process. So what I did was I cracked it and thought, well, okay, then I won't walk at all. So I didn't walk at all for nearly 2 weeks. And put on about 8 kilos.
That's garbage. You put on 8 kilos.
Wow. Maybe half of that. So I've had to go take drastic measures because it's what happens in coronavirus times. So anyway, so if I'm a bit lethargic to start with,
well hang on,
I'll get myself rolling.
Why would you be lethargic? Is today
yesterday or 5 days? No, yesterday was a fast day, but as of 6:10, I haven't really eaten anything. To start the morning just yet. So, yesterday I had a banana, I had 3 strawberries, and I had a bowl of chicken soup.
That doesn't sound like 600 calories to me. It sounds a lot less than 600 calories.
Well, it probably was a little bit. Banana's about 100 calories, I think.
Mm, 3 strawberries.
The soup's 250. I had a cup of tea. And I had 3 strawberries.
I reckon you've underdone it. And this is the thing, mate. You can't go under on the starvation days.
Well, you can.
Well, you can. But it becomes worse because then you get super duper hungry. Then you go berserk on your 5 days.
Well, I went to bed last night at 7:20 because I was so hungry.
Sorry, what?
I went to bed at 7:20 because I just couldn't handle it. So when the kids went to bed, I went to bed. So there you go. And there's 2 games of football today. There is, well, should be, Essendon and West Coast and also Hawthorn and the Crows. And interestingly, they're playing Joe Danaher. Now, remember last time when they played Joe Danaher off a short break on Anzac Day, that was when it all started to unravel for him. So they must be confident that they've got it right this time for him to play tonight. Would you played him?
Well, They need to know more about how it's all been managed, but they've held on to him for so bloody long that surely they got him to a point where if he's going to play, he would be able to back up and not just play, put out a tester, put him out there for a tester and see what happened. That they had to have some level of confidence that he would be able to stay on his two feet. And if he could do it once, why couldn't he do it twice? So I think he needs to know a bit more about his build-up from inside the club, but I just can't get myself to a point to think that they would put him out there and just hope in that first occasion. So if you put him out there and not hope and know, like they clearly thought they did on Thursday night against the Hawks, then yeah, you could play him again tonight.
Everyone else, it's an interesting one. It's an interesting one because there's a number of things at play, and obviously number one for him is his health, his body, his fitness. But they play tonight, Essendon, and they play again on Sunday. So, and the game on Sunday is against the Cats. Now, I don't think that Essendon can make the finals. I just want to make that perfectly clear. But their season is still essentially alive. So do they just throw all they can and give themselves a chance at making it while they can? Or do they play the long game? Now, what is the long game with Joe Danaher? Because we don't know whether he's going to stay at Essendon next year or not. They're playing Heppel tonight for the first time since round one. So they're certainly, you know, trying to play as good a team as possible. It'll be interesting. I just thought it was interesting what they were going to do with him. It's emotional just talking about it. Just whether they would say, look, Joe, don't play this one, but play Sunday. Or maybe they don't play him on Sunday. I'm not sure. But I would have thought that is a big tick for his recovery from this groin injury, that they are that confident that they're happy to play him off a short break.
But, I would agree with that. I just don't think they would have got to a point where they'd play him at all unless they are absolutely sure.
Yeah.
Considering his value, either from a future of the club perspective or a trade table perspective, I just don't think they would test him through a game like they did, like they could have last week, unless they, of course, knew, well, certainly within the rights of normal football procedure, that he would be fine and be able to back it up. And he was fit enough to be able to roll through for the majority of the season.
Yeah, I do think the other interesting part, I'm not sure whether we had this discussion on the radio or off the radio with Jimmy Bartel yesterday, but with Joe, he's had the good game now, so his currency, I would have thought, is significantly higher now than it was before he'd played that one game. Do you then just say, so cool your jets, Joe, we'll just hold on to you here, the price is high if they're thinking of potentially trading him. If he was to play and break down, or if he was to play and play some poor games from now and all these sorts of things, then his price goes down. They've got the good game into him. He had an amazing game last week. Are they better to just not play him again if they're looking at selling him? So there's been a lot of talk, and I think we should say this, Daniel, there's been a lot of talk last week that Joe was set to stay and it's all systems go and all this sort of thing. Joe hasn't made his mind up as to whether he's going to stay or not. That's reading into things for what you want to hear in that situation, because you're searching for information. He's miles away from making a decision. Yep.
He said, now you might have spoken to Rammer or not, I'm not sure, but he said on camera, I'm going to do whatever it was, paraphrase, do it for this club.
Yep.
So that would suggest that he wants to stay at Essendon. When he was saying it, around about the conversation that do it for this club, stay at Essendon. That's what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
That was the line that got people talking.
I understand why people did get talking on it, but I didn't read it that way. I think people will sort of take on to whatever they can. I mean, he's certainly in a better space than he was this time last year. There's definitely a better chance of him staying than what there was at this time last year, but I still think he's miles away from making a decision as to what he wants to do. I mean, he's played one game since, in over 15 months. Anyway, now, we'll talk more footy a bit later on, but I want to ask you, what did you think of John Rahm's performance yesterday?
Well, that finish to the BMW Championship was something quite extraordinary. Now, we were sort of following the progress through, and Johnny Rahm had got himself a two-shot lead leading into into the clubhouse, and really it was only Dustin Johnson that was going to chase him and have a crack at his chance to square it up. And then when Dustin Johnson nailed that putt on 18 in regulation...
From about 50 feet?
From... there was a 3% chance of dropping, according to the numbers, the effective golf champion data people, whoever they are. It was a 3% chance of making that putt, Dustin Johnson. Snaking 30-odd footer, 40-footer, over mountains, through valleys, down the hill, and into straight into the back of the cup. Like, it was zero chance of him doing that. So if I was Johnny Rahm, who was on the range practicing just in case, which was probably a smart play from Johnny in the end, I would have been going, well, really, all I'd have to do is wait for him to sign his card because this is mine, this tournament. And then he drains this bloody putt. And then has to deal with that, has to deal with the emotional turmoil of that, which I'm sure wouldn't have been easy because he had one hand on the trophy as Johnson was over that putt on 18. Then he gets up to the tee on 18 for the playoff and then butchers his drive. And Dustin Johnson gets a really lucky bounce of his in the middle of the fairway. And Johnny Rahm hits the second to 66 feet. It'll be a number we'll remember for a long time, golf fans, watching that yesterday, Whitey. 66 feet away from the pin. Left to right, up the down, up the mountain, down the valley, through the snake. And he drains it. I don't think I've seen golf quite like that in recent times. No. I don't think there's been that much drama and skill, and clearly an element of luck to a degree, but skill from two players shown in pressure moments for a long, long time.
No, I agree with you. The one event that stands out to me was the President's Cup back in South Africa, and this was in the early 2000s when Ernie Els and Tiger Woods were at their prime, and it was getting dark, and they had to go to extra holes to try and determine the winner, and they kept holing putts under pressure, both of them, to the point where it got dark, and the two captains got together and said, Gary Player and I think it was Jack Nicklaus, and said, let's just call it a draw, because they just kept holding all these putts under pressure, and it seemed a shame that someone would win in the dark when it was a bit unfair. It would be a bit of luck. But this was a scenario, as you say, that the difficulty of Dustin Johnson's putt was incredible, because it went down a hill, and as you said, the hole was in a bowl, so it dips down late and sort of turns left to right. It never looked like missing.
No.
And then when John Rahm was on the green, as you said, 66 feet away, the commentators actually said this is one of the most difficult putts on the golf course, and inferred the fact that it was more than likely that he'd three-putt. So it was just a matter of trying to get it close enough to make sure he got a chance for par, because Dustin Johnson was 30-odd feet away. And he holds the putt. Now, the reason I wanted to talk about this briefly, apart from the fact that it was quite incredible, and it was a playoff event on the PGA Tour, they're number one and number two in the world at the moment, these two, Dustin Johnson and John Rahm.
Yep.
But and I've said this before, Half, there is something magical about this bloke, John Rahm. He does the miraculous often. And, you know, it sort of falls into almost the Seve Ballesteros category of someone that just does freakish stuff on a regular basis. This guy, John Rahm's only 25. And as I said last time, he's 25, but he looks 45.
He does people, 50, yeah.
I don't think people quite appreciate what he's been able to achieve in such a short period of time. For someone that is only 25, he's only been a professional for about 3 years. He's now won 5 times on the PGA Tour and 6 times on the European Tour. And on the European Tour, he's won 2 Rolex events and 2 Tour Championships, and now he's got a playoff on the PGA Tour. And he's got 6 top 15s and he's in since the start of 2018 in majors. Now, clearly, he's still got to win a major. But he's also won 11 college tournaments before he turned pro. So this guy wins. And there was an incident on the... I saw on the... And I know you've seen this as well, on the practice fairway. He's, you know, practicing away, waiting for Dustin to finish.
Yeah.
And then as soon as the ball went in the hole, rather than go, oh, no, he just nodded and said, right, back to work. Let's get this done. Yeah. Like, he just thrives on these big, high-pressure moments. And I love that about any athlete. But John Rahm's got the charisma as well. He's a very aggressive player. He's very imaginative. But under pressure, he just seems to find a way to get the job done.
He does seem to enjoy the moment when he has to test himself. He quite likes that, seemingly. he's more than capable, to your point. There is something special about him because he's more than capable of pretty much doing whatever the hell he likes in that moment. There's not too many players that will have the confidence to think like that, let alone the ability to execute it. He's quite remarkable. I really enjoy watching Johnny Rahm play. So, and you fast swing, like he's got a swing like a lot of local golfers, I reckon. Like it's a really fast tempo swing.
Yeah, it's very
nothing
aggressive.
Rhythmical or smooth about it. It's fast and aggressive, and you can relate to him a little bit in many ways. He looks like one of us. He swings like one of us. He's good to watch. He's good to watch. I quite like him. Yeah, man, Johnny Rahm, well done to him.
Yeah, another interesting story that has happened in
and the
last sort of 24 hours
or
so.
At $10 till we had
well, we know that. I just really didn't
we had a couple hundred on him at the $10 for the Punters Club, so that was helpful.
Yeah, I didn't really want to talk about that.
That was helpful. The kitty's looking nice now.
Okay. we talked about Lionel Messi wanting to leave Barcelona.
Yes.
And it's got... Pardon the pun. It's got messy. Yeah.
I knew you were going to say that.
Because he missed a coronavirus test for Barcelona, sort of part of their pre-season on Sunday morning. And essentially, what they think is happening is he's saying, well, stuff you, I'm not coming back. And I'm going to boycott the pre-season until you transfer me. But the conundrum facing a lot of people in this process is that there is a release clause in his contract, which is set at $1.1 billion.
That seems to be a lot.
That's a lot of money. So that makes it hard for him to leave, a club that he's been at since he was 13 years of age. But he apparently is desperate to get to the Premier League. And it would appear Manchester City.
Well, there's only one that can afford it.
Well, yes, probably. But there are... there's talks about a couple of other clubs that might be interested as well. I mean, everyone would be interested, but as you say, that have got the money to be able to afford him. But, it'll be fascinating to see how that all plays out because obviously Barcelona want to keep arguably the best player in the world. But, a $1.1 billion contract clause.
Yeah,
very interesting.
That's a significant buyout for a footballer. Isn't it? Let's think about that for a second. A footballer. $1.1 billion. Like, that doesn't make any sense, does it, really? That's actually gratuitous and ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it's totally unreal, but that's exactly how real it is. $1.1
You'd do a lot with $1.1 billion if you were Barcelona.
Well, you could do... if you're anyone, you could do a lot with $1.1 billion. Goodness gracious me. It's a remarkable number. But that's the life of these megastar footballers, these megastar soccer players. When you said it, like, because I read that story and you think, oh, that's a bloody lot of money. But when you say it, even just saying it, it puts you on your heels a bit. The price for one person, $1.1 billion. Not sure about that.
The other thing I wanted to talk about, which we didn't get a chance to talk about yesterday, is this maybe a bit of a war developing between Channel 7 and Cricket Australia. James Warburton over the weekend really fired up with some extremely strong comments about Cricket Australia.
Yes.
And this feeling, this growing feeling that Channel 7 might walk away from the cricket. Now, I don't think it will happen, but talking to a few people over the weekend, it's got a few people nervous as to what may or may not happen. Now, remember back in, I think it would have been March or April, when Peter Volandis got on the front foot and whacked Channel 9 over its lack of professionalism and all these sorts of things. And I think everyone goes, whoa, what's going to happen here? Now, in the end, it sort of sharpened Channel 9 up a bit, didn't it? And the deal got done and everyone walked away apparently happy. Whether James Warburton is trying to do the same here, James Warburton's the CEO of Channel 7, or whether there's a little bit more angst around and uncertainty, I'm not sure. But as I said, talking to a few people over the weekend, they were like, I'm not sure how this is going to play out. And one of the big issues, and look, I don't think it's anybody's fault necessarily, But Channel 7 was really worried about the Big Bash last year and the lack of star power that played in the Big Bash, and that was one of the reasons why the ratings had dropped. And this year it's going to be, no, in fact, it's going to be worse, because what Cricket Australia are saying is probably the best players, the international players, are going to be in a bubble to play test matches and to play one-day internationals and these sorts of things, which will mean that there's a very strong chance they're not going to be able to play in the Big Bash. Add to that the international players that aren't going to be able to come and play either. Yeah. There's every chance that you and I will be suiting up for the Melbourne Stars or the Melbourne Renegades, which I'm quite
surprised
excited
it hasn't
about.
Happened to this point.
Well, there's been some phone calls. But Channel 7 are going, well, this isn't what we want. This is not what we've signed millions and millions of dollars up for, to have a Bush League type concept for the Big Bash. And Cricket Australia aren't giving them the answers they want. For Channel 7 to feel confident about things. So I think it's more about the Big Bash than the international summer. But even that, there's still uncertainty around, well, when are you going to play those test matches? Now, I think it's slightly unfair on Cricket Australia to be saying, well, we don't know what's happening with the coronavirus. No one knows the answer to that. But there's some real angst, because there's lots of money at stake. And if Channel 7 aren't getting bang for their buck, they feel that they have the option to walk away.
Well, you've very signed on for a certain deal, and if that deal doesn't eventuate, then you've got grounds to have discussions about what.
Well, that's what this that is looks exactly like. Right.
So I understand their frustration, and not only from a coronavirus situation, but from a programming situation from Cricket Australia. And you'd think that they would want to be keeping their major broadcast partner in a set of free-to-air broadcast partners, certainly very, very closely by them. Throughout the conversation, it just seems like they've been at arm's length, which, if I was James Warburton and I've paid hundreds of millions of dollars for the rights for this program, for this competition, I would be a little bit miffed at that.
Yep. Well, between Seven and Fox, it's $1.2
billion. Lionel Messi sort of stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe they can get Lionel Messi to play in the Big Bash. That might help. But, I mean, even there's no certainty even over the international fixture, because we don't know whether India are going to play Boxing Day at the MCG. We think it's probably not going to happen, but we don't know. There was a thought that maybe they would push the international summer back and play it in sort of the second half of January into February to give it the best chance of, because it is against India, and play all the domestic stuff first. There was speculation, even from a domestic point of view, over the last few days, that maybe they'll play the Sheffield Shield in a bubble in South Australia, where there are three grounds available, and they'll just play five games back-to-back and get the first half of the domestic season out the way that way. So there's so much unknown. Cricket didn't think it would be affected by the coronavirus back in April. It now is clearly going to be affected by it, and these are the sort of ramifications that are unfolding in front of our eyes at the moment.
Yep. We'll certainly pay attention to it with great interest, because it's going to be a big story building up to the summer. But broadcast partners fighting with sporting bodies is a very sexy story too. People like that sort of stuff for whatever reason. So it's
absolutely
it's a good story to follow from an outsider's perspective or a fan's perspective. See who's got the whip hand when it comes to the reality of sport. Speaking of ramifications, front page of the Herald Sun's got a story with ramifications today. There's seemingly been investigation into the death of Danny Frawley, former Saints champ Danny Frawley, and there has been a finding that he had stage 2 CTE, diagnosis of stage 2 CTE, which is that chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is the brain injury, which has been well researched and well talked about in the last couple of years in the world of sport, concussive injuries and repetitive stress injuries to the head. It does highlight again, if you're any sporting body that has a physical component to the game that you govern, there would be a lot of people reading that this morning going, right, this is actually happening, because it's one of those diseases and situations you can only find out post-mortem, the CTE diagnosis. This is real. This is not just in the US. This is not one of those stories over there. This is real for a lot of sporting bodies, and we need to be making sure that we've got absolutely every possible I dotted and T crossed in terms of how we work with our athletes for protocols when there are head knocks and how we try and limit those and protect them throughout the course of any sporting activity. I reckon this will send a few shockwaves through sporting bodies across the nation, this one today.
Yeah, no doubt about that. I mean, I think it's been spoken about for a long time, but when you connect one of football's favourite people, Danny Frawley, to this sort of thing, I think it sparks a bit more emotion.
Yep.
Because he's such an identifiable figure, both from a media perspective, but obviously he was a coach and a player. Everybody knew Danny Frawley. And there's been a lot of other players that have been fighting this, for quite a while, but this adds an extra layer of, I don't know what you'd call it, but impact, I think, on this whole thing. I mean, look, the thing, so much has changed, Half, in the last 10 years when it comes to the way that we treat concussion.
No doubt.
And the way we, just the whole thing around, it's no longer brave to get back up and, stumble to your feet and play on. I remember there were times where players would get carried off, knocked out on a stretcher, and then they'd come back on half an hour later and everyone would stand and applaud to say how brave he was. Now, I mean, that doesn't happen anymore. If that was to happen, everyone would be going, hey, get back off. No, don't go back on.
Yeah, well, they wouldn't even put him on.
And clearly they wouldn't go back on. But there has been a significant change. And so I think, again, we're talking about something that happened a long time ago with Danny when he played. Yep. But and I think it does show, if you look at when he played to where we play now, concussion is handled very, very differently. And we just had weekend with Brad Ebert at Port Adelaide, who's had a lot of concussion issues. There was a concern that he had another head knock, having missed a lot of footy just this year, and then it was determined, no, it was actually more of a facial injury than a concussion situation, and he was able to come back on. But everyone is a lot more cautious than what they were.
No doubt. It was quite confronting, but reading that story today from
Danny. For you? What about, do you get slightly concerned by it with the concussions that you had when you played, when you read something like that?
I certainly read it with interest. I'm not sure I get concerned, because, as you know, I'm fairly pragmatic about these sort of things. What's happened's happened. There's not too much you can do about it. And I had a few nasty whacks, but not concerned, but I certainly pay attention, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I pay attention.
Alert, not alarmed.
Yeah, very. Who was it? Steve Liebman do those ads? Was that him? Whatever.
I think it was.
Yeah, alert, not alarmed. I think that's the way to do it. I certainly pay attention. Craig Gabriel, though, he's covering the US Open at Flushing Meadow, day one action, and there's no more excited man on the planet when it comes to the US Open than our Lacoste-wearing connoisseur of fine goods across the globe. Good morning, Craig.
How you doing?
How you doing?
I'm doing. I'm getting there, you know.
Before we get to the tennis, Craig, there's a text message that's come in, because a couple of weeks ago we were talking about the efforts of Joey Chestnut, who breaks hot dog records all the time. And it sort of came to our attention about your chicken satay stick eating efforts. How many chicken satay sticks did you eat in one setting, please?
82.
What?
It was not just chicken. It was chicken and beef.
That is outrageous.
I still hold the record on the tennis tour for the most. And it was at the Satay Club in Singapore when we used to have a men's tournament over there. But what was even better is that I won the sprint back to the hotel.
You crazy tennis journos. You crazy guys.
It wasn't with journos. It was with tournament officials as well as some players. And I don't know if you ever remember a New Zealand player named Kelly Evenden. He was so upset because he didn't even feature in the top three.
Goodness me.
Is that the Wimbledon of satay eating, that you actually did it at the Satay Club?
You've given it that title. I'll take that one.
Goodness gracious me. Fantastic. What a way to open the proceedings today. What a way. Now, Craig, the US Open itself has kicked off. I don't think you're at Flushing Meadows, but how is this experience different for you, let alone the participants? Yeah.
It's so weird. It really is. It's just so strange to be watching it from, 15, 17,000 kilometers away, whatever it is. It's frustrating. It's disappointing. But, hey, that's the way it is at the moment. I mean, you have to also feel for the players in that they're playing matches in front in empty courts. And the U.S. Open is often the loudest and the most brash and aggressive of all the majors and most of the tournaments. And they don't have any sort of feeling or atmosphere out there at all. But look, the couple of guys that I've spoken to already, they said they're just putting up with it. I've spoken to Jordan Thompson, Lizette Cabrera, also with Alia Tomljanovic, and even all those sorts of things. It's all by virtual media conferences.
Yeah, right. Okay. Okay, a different world we live in. And has a job for Novak Djokovic been a little bit easier today with Diego Schwartzman being bundled out, as we say?
This is a long way to go. I mean, Schwartzman should have won that. I mean, he lost to a Brit. Can you believe it? after being up two sets to love it, I think he even had two match points. And Cam Norrie ended up winning that. But, none of the players would be looking at that sort of a situation. It's just the next match and the next match. So, yeah.
Any other strong performances from some seeds out there that look pretty sharp? Tsitsipas looked pretty good.
Who was that?
Tsitsipas.
Tsitsipas was dynamic. 6-2, 6-1, 6-1 over Albert Ramos-Vinolas. Alexander Zverev has just defeated Kevin Anderson. Those were the highest profile first round match, and Zverev won that 7-6, 5-7, 6-3, 7-5. So very, very tough. And I'm just looking at pictures of Zverev looking at a monitor, and his brother, who I think has had a touch of COVID, was on the monitor waving at him and wishing him the best.
It was interesting, Craig, talking to Darren Cahill yesterday. He mentioned that he thought the courts were going to be considerably quicker this year. So yep. that was a danger game for Zverev, because Kevin Anderson's got one of the biggest serves in the game. From what you've seen, I know it's only the first day, do you feel that the courts are playing a little bit quicker?
Yeah, look, at least they've had some experience on the courts, because a lot of these guys and girls did play what was the Cincinnati Masters that was played here on these same courts last week. But they didn't get the advantage of playing on, like, the Arthur Ashe Stadium, et cetera. But a few of them said that some of the courts are certainly quicker. And that was a danger match for Zverev. So it would not have surprised me one iota if Kevin Anderson had got up and won that. But I think Zverev can take positives away in getting through that the way he did.
And from a female perspective, Angelique Kerber had a win. She's knocked out an Australian, Anna Tomljanovic. And again, just using the reference of Darren, who's over there, he seemed to think that Kerber might have been a bit of a sneaky chance this week, particularly considering the amount of the top women that are not playing. Kerber hasn't been in the best of forms over the last sort of 12 months or so, but maybe, just maybe, she's the one to watch.
Look, that certainly is possible. I mean, she's done very well over here in the past, so she's familiar with the whole setup. We'll see. Her problem is her head. She can be so flaky and fragile on the mental side of her game. And, if anybody puts some pressure on her, she can crumble. So that's going to be the important aspect as far as Kerber is concerned. I should just tell you, there's an Australian on court at the moment. It's Madison Inglis, but she's in all sorts of trouble. She's playing the 24th seed Magda Linette, and it's 5-1 to the Polish player.
And it's doubleheader today to kick off round 15. I'm sure that's very exciting news for Rodney Ead, who knows plenty about the coaching caper. And the Coach's Corner is a great segment here on the Breakfast Club. So what do you think, Rocket? Good morning.
Morning, Daniel. Morning, Adam. How are you going? Very well?
We're very well.
Yeah, good, good.
How's yourself?
Yeah, up and about. Up and about. Looking forward to the footy again.
Daniel? Up and about. Good stuff.
I don't know if the first game today is one of the highlights on the calendar, but other than that, looking forward to the second game.
So not overly anticipating great performance from Hawthorn and Adelaide, but the Eagles and the Bombers has caught your attention, has it?
Yes. The Bombers with Stringer and Danaher in the side seem to be an appealing sort of combination, doesn't it, if they get their game time into them, even though their first half was disappointing last week. But they might be able to actually push the Eagles tonight.
What would your... We were talking about this earlier today and a little bit yesterday, in fairness. What would your tactic be with Joe Danaher, Rocket? Because he's seemingly a very valuable commodity, has interest from outside of your club if he wants to move forward in his career somewhere else. How would you manage him? Because it looks like he's going to play tonight after his first game on Thursday. Was that a four-day break between?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a... It's a bit of a concern, isn't it, that... In racing parlance, not on a racing person, second up after a spell. It's not normally not that good, is it? So he is a history of injury, so I'd be really, really worried about tonight or the next game. I don't know how much day break there is to the third game. But they'd have to manage him at some stage. Now, whether that's managing during a game, whether just leave him deep at times so he doesn't run as much. But you end up, if you are playing deep, you end up being a bit more explosive. So they should know internally, but you'd hate to see him do a calf or a groin or you know, actually do something in the next game or two. But he looked exciting at the weekend. He was fresh, obviously. Obviously showed his talent, seemed happy to be back and happy to be playing. So if he can stay fit, it certainly adds another dimension to the Bombers, that's for sure.
I think it's a good point you make, Rocket. It's not just about looking after his groins, it's making sure that after having missed so much that he doesn't ping a calf or a hamstring, and he did a calf during this last sort of 2 months in the build-up to his first game. So, look, I don't know. We were talking about it earlier this morning. They kind of got to get him out there and play him just to see what he can do. Now, did they get enough evidence from that first game against Hawthorn, or do they need more? And when I say they, it's not just Essendon, it's himself and his manager, it's other potential clubs. They need to see what he's still capable of doing.
Yeah, it's a good point, but he has displayed it. So now do you put him on ice a bit rather than risk him getting injured? So it's sort of you're tantalising the whole market. Only they will know internally whether he's a good chance of staying, or if he's a good chance of staying, even if he's going to go, you'd don't want to risk him breaking down, and how important is it to make the finals for them? So it's a weighing up. But I'd look after his health. I'd 4 day break is a bit it is quick. It is a quick turnaround. The cumulative effect of his fatigue, they'll only know too how much work they've put into him. But it's nothing like playing. The games are another level up. So if he plays tonight, I think there'd be a fair chance of missing game three.
Yeah, so it's Geelong on Sunday, the third in that grouping of matches for Essendon. They've already had their bye, forced through that situation earlier in the season, so they don't get that luxury of some of the other teams at this time of the year. Rocket, they've got West Coast tonight, Essendon. They've got Geelong on Sunday, as I mentioned. With the players that they've got back, they're only half a game outside the eight. I don't think they can make it personally. Do you think that they can worry, particularly West Coast tonight, with the players that they've got back? Heppel's another one that's playing his first game for a very long time tonight.
I think they can. Obviously, Kennedy out as well. So there is some structural changes that suit the Bombers. Heppel... even though Danaher did very well on the weekend, well, it's not a weekend, when the last played a few days ago, I'm always a bit mindful of players that have been out for a long time, so I wouldn't expect a lot of Heppel. I think his leadership will help, but I wouldn't expect too much from him. I think he'll build himself up to form in the... his third and fourth game. I think they can trouble the best teams. There's no doubt about that. You just don't know whether they're going to perform consistently enough. That's their biggest issue. And you worry about their game style as well, actually building from the back half consistently all the time, rather than try and have a bit of front half football as well. Yeah, I think they can. They've got some. They've got some weapons in their team, but I'm like you. I don't think they'll make it. I think these two games in a row now, even if they beat the Eagles in 5 days' time, then playing Geelong, I'm not too sure they'll make it. But if they win the next two, well, they deserve to make it. But I'm a bit like you. I think they'll miss.
What about the Bulldogs, Rocket? They're sitting just outside the eight at the moment on percentage. And they've gone into the last couple of games, well, a fair few games, without a recognised second ruck. Now, this is not totally unusual. We saw Richmond do this a couple of years ago with Sean Grigg when Nankervis or whoever was having the major ruck duties for the Tigers wasn't out there on the field having a rest or whatever, that we'd see a mobile ruck go in like Sean Grigg, and it became a bit of a trend. And the Bulldogs have got it back in town in the last couple of weeks. But it's seemingly they've been found wanting against decent ruck options or second ruck options in opposition teams. Can they survive with this system that they're running with at the moment, with Josh Dunkley in the ruck or Jack McRae in the ruck as the second player?
No, I don't. I don't think they can. I think there's a few elements to it. I don't mind the theory of it, where you can say you lose the hit out, but we'll win around the contest. That's fine. What it's done, though, and I think the unintended consequences of it, is what it's done to the two individual players. I think English now is, even though he's a young lad and probably up and down a little bit, is totally bereft of confidence. They're really just reeling him out as a centre bounce option, as a decoy, and then throwing him forward, and he's not a forward. Yep. He's taken a few marks forward during the year as a ruckman rolling with the play forward, rather than as a... He's getting underneath the ball, and I think Dunkley... I think it's worn, even though it's his second or third game back, he looks tired from having to wrestle in the ruck. And I understand the theory, they've got their three on-ballers, then Dunkley comes in after the bounce, and they've got four on-ballers. But his form's not great. And I don't think it's a positive for the way that they want that short ruckman to have an impact around the ground. And I don't think Dunkley's playing. So I think it's worn him. I think it's wearing him. Yeah, okay. I think McRae didn't play that well the other night, so therefore... There's the concept and the tactic of it, but also the individuals involved and opposition aware of it now. So how can Dunkley go against Hawkins when it's 20 metres out from goal? Hawkins grabs that and kicks a goal, and he tried a couple of times. Mm. Yeah, so I think they might have to shelve that. I think they might have to shelve it and reel it out. And when Grigg was doing it for Richmond, it was for 10 minutes here and 10 minutes there. It wasn't for patches of 50 and 60, 80 minutes. So I think the shock value, I must admit, I think they can wheel it out every now and then for 5 and 10 minutes patches, but not for a whole game. I don't think it's going to work for them.
And it probably takes away one of the rotations too. You wonder why they look tired, Rocket. They're all out there at the same time all the time, the key players through the midfield of the Bulldogs, rather than having one of them rotating through the free spot on the bench. They don't get a chance to do that because they're all out there all the time.
Yeah, for sure. So I think there's a few elements to it and a few unintended consequences. And generally, when you try that tactic, it's not for game in, game out. It's not for a whole game, as I said. So, yeah, I think there's no shock value anymore, so the opposition know what they're going to do. So they not... I don't think it's any benefit to the Bulldogs as well. And I think the confidence level of the two players, I think... Dunkley's a bit of a, he's a shadow of what he can produce. And English, it's certainly taken the confidence around from him because it's saying to him, no, we haven't got confidence in you. So he's just for the centre bounce and that's it.
It was kind of forced on them a little bit because English had that ankle injury from a couple of weeks ago and they tried to sort of nurse him through a little bit. But English is almost, Rocket, the barometer for the Bulldogs because when he plays well, the Bulldogs seem to play well. But when he's knocked off the footy or he's sort of outsized by the bigger ruckman, the Bulldogs do seem to really struggle without that dominance in the ruck.
Yeah, they do. Not that he was ever dominant, I don't think. He had a couple of games, but no. I think it was more about at least breaking even. At least the opposition couldn't direct the ball. He's certainly not an aggressive ruckman. And I think they've taken him out, maybe whether to nurse him, but it seemed... strange for a whole game, especially in the back line. Close to goal, as I said, with Hawkins is doing the ruck work. You've got Dunkley doing it or McRae doing it. It's, you'd have your hand in your mouth there about that. It's a bit of a worry. But, yeah, I'm interested to see what they do. I think there was a good performance from them the other night. A couple of mistakes really cost them. I know they had a couple of players off. They fought the game out. A couple of mistakes cost them badly. But now that they've played an extra game than other teams and they're a game out or half a game out, I'm not too sure they can make it. I think they'll miss.
That was really an important point for him actually coming back is, not just to be a one-hit wonder and play that one game and then not be able to back it up in 4 or 5 days' time, because we knew that this was going to happen. So I have no doubt that Big Maxi will be out there on the weekend.
That is the voice of Jake Lever, who was very good again for the D's on the weekend in the Alice against St Kilda, talking about his captain, Max Gawn, who returned from injury on the weekend and put up a hell of a performance against two outstanding St Kilda ruckmen as well. And he joins us, the skipper of the D's, on the Breakfast Club this morning. Good morning, Max.
I think my computer shut down when I heard Jake Lever say I was a one-hit wonder.
Well, no, he didn't want you to be the one-hit wonder. He wanted you to come back and be able to go again, Max, which is what we hope you can as well. Is Jake right? Are you okay? Did you pull up okay from the weekend?
Yeah, I did. We were talking in the break. It was a tough contest for me to be first up against two very good rucks, and one of them in particular, Paddy Ryder, is very good at centre bounce, and obviously the PCL injury is something that can come up again in centre bounces for rucks, so I had to be careful there, but I got through. Travelled home well, no swelling in the knee, and was able to do even the flush run yesterday, which I wasn't expecting to do before the game.
Were you nervous at all, Max, going in? It was obviously a massive game for the club, but you play such an important role in the fortunes of the footy team. Was it touch and go that you definitely play?
It wasn't touch and go at all. I made the call that I was playing in my own head. Every now and then I'd feel my knee, especially when you fly 5 hours before the game. It's a little bit interesting and gained a little bit of swelling on that flight, but once I got walking around in Alice Springs and got moving and then got to the ground, I was relatively comfortable. But I always knew I was in for a big task, because there's only one way I can sort of beat Paddy Ryder in centre bounces, and it's cracking in harder than he does. So I wasn't able to do that really in the first quarter, second quarter, but I got going late.
And have you pulled up, more importantly?
Yeah, really, really good. There is no swelling. So it's a pretty historical knee of mine. I've had a lot of surgeries. I had eight surgeries all up this knee, so I've got to look after it, but it's pulled up really well.
Amazing. What about the victory itself, Max? You had to work hard for it, and I was speaking to Stephen May post-game and talked about the way he defended St Kilda's leapfrog tactics that they try to use with Bradley Hill as that link player from the back half and speeding forward. Were you really pleased? How pleased were you with the way you were able to stand up and execute a plan, but more importantly, hang on for the win?
Yeah, it was an incredible game. We started really well, and then they pegged us back inch by inch, and I think they even might have got in front maybe in the last quarter.
They did.
So it was a fun game to play in. I'm not sure what it would have been like to watch with that low scoring, but I'm sure the intensity would have still grabbed a few viewers' eyes. But Brad Hill won the last sort of 6 clearances. He was unbelievable late. And then he would just kick it in, and then our backmen were being unbelievable as well, and Jake Lever and Stephen May and Michael Hibbert, who came back on and made a really, really big tackle late in the game as well. So it was a really good game. The centre bounce was probably an issue for us. We got smacked in that. They didn't end up in goals, but they did end up in causing our backmen to be in more and more contests. So we'll try and fix that up going into Sydney, but apart from that, we're really happy with how our defence stood up.
Yeah, Rocket said that before. We were speaking to Rocket before the break about the way what he thought about the way you played. You said you defended much better. It was obviously a bit of a system in place too. You let them come at you a bit and held your ground, which stopped their flow and took away their energy. It was a good plan in place. When you get a situation where you have to defend a little bit differently than you normally would week in, week out, do you get nervous about that on game day because you can get back into old habits?
Yeah, you definitely get nervous about how teams attack. But the last 2 games, especially Western Bulldogs and Saints, attacked the same way. And Sydney, the game we got coming up, are very similar as well. They all love to get it on the open side and go through the corridor. And That's part of our defence that we feel like has stood up, apart from the Western Bulldogs game. And I find that the real delicate part of coaching is you almost have to keep on reminding people every 3 or 4 weeks about the exact same thing, because players drift. We drift to different things and different coaching things get brought in week to week. So you always have to remind the defensive structures every 3 or 4 weeks. And the Western Bulldogs, unfortunately, we just weren't at our best. But we were able to defend against a similar team in St Kilda, a lot better, and we got it again this week with Sydney.
I want to ask you about Clayton Oliver. He had 10 or 11 possessions in the last quarter against St Kilda, and he's one of very few players that can just switch gears when the game is on the line and just do some amazing things. What's he like when that's happening? Is it something that he's said to him at, say, a three-quarter time situation or a particular stoppage? Is he animated, or does he just go about his work and not say too much? Because he definitely has this extra gear that he can go to.
He's got an extreme desire for a will to win, which is a great quality to have, and almost as strong of a quality I've seen in anyone in terms of their will to win. So he, when the game's on the line, he just goes up another gear and has done since his debut almost. And there's a great midfield balance going on there at the moment with Christian and Angus and Jack as well. But the four of them really complemented each other, and Jack was able to take Jack Steele in the second half, which freed up Clayton a little bit more because Clayton was going head-to-head with him early. And then that just freed him up a little bit in the last quarter. So you can probably put that down to Jack doing his bit and Christian able to sacrifice his spot in the midfield and go forward, which ended up being good for him because he kicked four goals. But they're a good little midfield and they're working for each other. And this was Clayton's week this week where he dominated the last quarter, but next week could be Angus and the following week could be Jack.
Time to touch base with Melbourne City. Now, it didn't go their way on the weekend, the A-League Grand Final against Sydney FC. It was an entertaining affair. A little bit of drama, of course, with the VAR controversy. It didn't go the way of our boys, but Scotty Jamieson, the captain, was sitting there watching it, I imagine, biting nails from start to finish. He joins us again. Scotty, good morning.
Morning, boys.
How was it? How were you? In the build-up and then during the game?
Yeah, it was pretty different, to be honest with you. The only times I've really watched grand finals has been times when it hasn't been my team. So you know, to sit there and not be a part of it was pretty tough. But it was a good start to the game. Unfortunately, we didn't capitalise with the VAR taking it off. But ultimately, yeah, it was just hard to watch. But I was proud of the players and the staff, and something that hopefully next time I can be a part of.
Was it harder than you thought, not being there?
No, not really. I knew it was going to be bloody hard. Emotions were all over the place. Like I said, I never really thought my team would play in the grand final and I wouldn't be a part of it. So, just one of those things. You know, it's happened before. Players have either been suspended and missed out on grand finals and, you know, I felt for them. So I was just the unfortunate one this year.
And what was your role through the week? Did you get involved via Zoom a few times and have a chat, or were you connected to the group throughout the week?
Earlier in the week, I was pretty hands-on with speaking to a lot of people. And then, you know, once we made the final, I kind of spoke and then let them be. I didn't really want to get too much into it. I'm sure they're getting sick and tired of receiving messages and I'm sure they want their time away from me for a little bit because I can chew their ear off. So towards the game, I stepped away a little bit let it play out.
Obviously, you never know, particularly in football where just one moment can change the result. But when you got to extra time, how were you feeling? Were you confident that you were the better team going into that, or were you a bit more nervous? What were your emotions?
Well, I mean, we started the game really well, and that gave me a lot of confidence. You know, grand finals can you don't have to play well, but momentum really helps you. And I thought, you know, we started well, and the momentum was on our side, and they probably caught it back towards half time. But you go into extra time, I actually thought it'd go to penalties. That was my feeling. I thought it was going to go to penalties here, and I wasn't worried or anything like that. And then, yeah, like each one incident changes the game, and that was the case with Ryan Grant chesting the ball in.
And so that was the emotion going into the extra time period. What about now, reflecting on, as you said, you know, it was almost unexpected that you got through to the grand final. We followed your progress now for a number of years, and the team's improved rapidly. Are you already looking forward to getting into next year, or do you need the break? What's the feeling now?
Well, it's different. I mean, for the team and myself, it's completely different. It's about them enjoying it, I guess enjoying a few beers, and just taking a step back. Myself, I've stepped back for about 2 or 3 weeks. I'm training pretty much tomorrow straight away. I'm back into it and preparing for trying to get back there next year. So, it's important for the players to take a step back. You have to appreciate the sacrifices that they've made. The staff also, being in a hub wasn't easy, and essentially, they need to spend time with their family. But myself, straight back into it and ready to go.
How do you describe the season for City, Scotty? Obviously, a grand final performance is a great achievement, but was that expected? Did you think you were good enough to go all the way, or was Sydney, as they showed throughout pretty much the home and away season, the best placed team for the competition?
Yeah, I think every season we go into, we look at the trophies on offer and we look to win. Now, unfortunately, we played in both grand finals and lost, so people could say it was a failure. Ultimately, we didn't get what we wanted, but at the same time, we've produced some records for our club in the sense of highest points. We've made Asia to compete in Asia next year, and we've really progressed as a club and as a team. So there's definitely some real positives there. But I'd be lying if I said I was disappointed. I wasn't disappointed that we didn't get a trophy. So that's the challenge now. We've done really well this year, but we need to win trophies.
We head north to the hub of the Carlton Football Club. We have a chat to the co-captain Sam Docherty. He's a big part of our team, and he's back again. Good morning, Doc.
Good morning, Half. How are you?
Well, I'm well, mate. I'm well, very well. Thank you for asking. It's bit different down here in the world. We're talking to Max Gorn before, and I don't know how far away he is from you, but it's 27 degrees where he is. Is it still hot up there for you?
Yes, it is. It's nice. We were looking over we just moved to the Royal Pines yesterday, so looking over the golf course, which is rather enjoyable for me.
How many moves have you made since you've been taken away from Victoria for the first time, or probably the only time? How many moves have you made from hotel to hotel?
We're up to 10. Eight different hotels. Is that second visit at the Pines?
Wow! I was expecting maybe four or five. I didn't expect 10.
No, we've had a fair few. We obviously went to Perth and we've had the Darwin trip as well. So we've had a few moves, but it's part and parcel of what we had to do.
Well, you've done a great job. The whole competition has done an amazing job to get to this point. So I think we can all acknowledge that. What about the weekend? Doc, we've talked about you a lot. In fact, the footy world has talked about you a lot in the last 48 hours or so, with a fair bit of analysis about your game against the Magpies. How did you see the wash-up from that game?
It was obviously pretty disappointing. We didn't play as well as we were hoping to going into the game. And, defensively, they did a lot of what they wanted to do in terms of their uncontested game, and they did it. Credit to Collingwood, they played really well, and they got their game going. They got their kick to release the pressure that which didn't allow us to put on the pressure deep in our forward line, and they chipped their way through us. So from that point of view, it was pretty disappointing. We still had our looks. I think we ended up winning the inside 50 count, but couldn't make the most of our opportunities when we got it in there. So unfortunately, it was a big loss for us, but we move on this week. We've got the short turnaround in 4 days, so we're playing in a couple of days. So we're already gearing up for GWS. We've just got to keep winning for the back end of the season now.
I'm interested, Doc, in just sort of sharing with us what it was like to playing in such a big game with big ramifications. I mean, obviously, you're slowly climbing up the ladder over the last few years, but this was a game of real consequence. What was the build-up like? And then in that early part of the third quarter where you had kind of control of the game, what was that like to know the importance of it and you were right in the thick of the action?
Yeah, well, we kept it as completely normal as we could. We go out to play our way and really hard against any opposition that we play against. And we had no different against Collingwood. We understood what would happen if the win or the loss came our way. And unfortunately, it didn't go our way. But we still have enough games in the back end of the season to still have a shake-up of it. So it was a bit of a build-up. We probably... being in Queensland, you got shielded from a fair chunk of it in terms of the Melbourne media, so the hype wasn't as much up here. But from a playing point of view, we knew that we had to go out there and get a win, and unfortunately we didn't. But it hasn't ruled us out of the back end of the season. And in the finals, we've still got eyes for to try and get in there. We just got to make sure that we win the rest of our games throughout here.
Yeah, I think it's a good point that you kind of shielded from it up there. But I mean, I know so many Carlton supporters, a lot of them are our listeners, just are loving the fact that your season is still alive so late in the year. I was just interested from a playing point of view and obviously a leader's point of view, just the satisfaction from a broader lens of the fact that you're on the right track, even though you didn't necessarily get the result on Sunday, that you're playing in the big games now.
Yeah, it's obviously a welcome change to have our season alive late in the season. It hasn't happened very much in my time at the club, so but it also creates the frustration, and we want to get there as quickly as we can, and we still have to make sure that we're winning enough games to get into the eight. So it's a bit of both worlds. You're happy that you're thereabouts and you're on the way up, but it still hurts just as much when you're losing games of footy.
So do you have to temper that or control the tempering of that conversation with the group, Doc, as one of the skippers at the Blues? Because everyone wants it to happen right now and go from being a lowly team to a really good team and a finals contending team straight away. The footy world doesn't really allow that to happen too often. There's some anomalies, of course, but is it part of your role to sort of control that messaging and control that conversation?
A little bit, but to be honest, our group's been very good at just sticking to our process and sticking to the team that we're playing and making sure that we're putting our best foot forward. We've had a message the whole year about at every game we're going to learn and we're going to get better, and I think we've done that. And we're focused on that purely, and we've probably said it a fair bit in the media, but the results do take care of themselves if you get the process right. So that's what we're more focused on. Obviously, on the weekend, there's a fair bit of a build-up for the game because what it meant. But after we finish, we've had 4 days, so we really just have to just move on and park it and get our learnings from it and move on towards GWS, which is a big game for us again.
Now, before we do move on, were you worried when Patrick Cripps went down? Did you see it? Do you have time to worry about it when you're still trying to play the game as well? Because I think there were a few hearts in mouths when he went off the ground.
Well, usually when you're on the ground, you don't have enough time to think about it. But I happened to be standing on the bench looking about 20 metres away from him, straight at him, watching his knee buckle and go down. So my heart was in my mouth, but that's probably because I'm a bit shielded from from my prior experiences and thinking worst case. To be honest, I see anyone buckle their knee or hyperextend their knee and I automatically think the worst. So that's not even from our footy club, that's from watching footy on TV. So I had to sort of compose myself. I probably was lucky that I was on the bench to compose myself before I went back out on the ground and made sure that I still trying to get the job done late in the game.
Yeah, well, it was a bit of a moment, and then of course he went and smashed Chris Mayne, who's come off worse for wear for the Magpies, and I think he sent a nice text on that too, the co-skipper there at the Blues, Paddy Cripps. But tell us about Tom DeConning, Doc, because I reckon he's a young man that would be getting plenty of attention from other clubs wanting to work out how they can acquire him. He's got a bit to give, this boy, hasn't he?
Yeah, and we've spoken for a long time about the talent that Big Tommy has, and I think we're starting to see big chunks of it in games at the moment. his centre bounce work is up there with the best. He's obviously a developing young ruckman, so the hard part for those boys is putting on size to compete against seasoned ruckmen that have been in the system for a long time, and sometimes they get pushed around a bit around the ground, but he's starting to hold up in that sense as well. So, we've been very excited about him for a while. It's not a matter of if he was going to be a good player, it's just a matter of when he could get the AFL body right and ready for senior footy and rucking at senior footy. It's a bit of a different position to the rest of them. You're only versing one guy, and that guy's usually pretty big and pretty strong. So, we're very excited about what he can bring, and I think we're seeing bits and pieces through games at the moment, which is really good.
Super Netball on the weekend. It wasn't another great weekend for the Magpies. 69-54, they went down to the Giants, which leaves them languishing on the bottom of the Suncorp Super Netball ladder after 8 rounds, 6 to go. And Kelsey Brown is one of our favourites from the Magpies Super Netball team. She's been good enough to join us this morning on the Breakfast Club. Good morning, Kels.
Hi, guys.
Now, you sound bright and bubbly, but all I want to do is give you a hug. What's happened?
I know. It's actually not as bad as I think everyone is thinking it is at the moment. It's not a full-blown rupture of my ACL, but it does spell the end of, I guess, the home and away season for me. So I am bright and bubbly because I'm not looking down the barrel of a 12-month recovery. It's sounding good to me.
Thankful for small mercies, I suppose. That's right. So explain to us what happened during the game. What did you feel when you thought that perhaps it might be that dreaded injury again? What happened to you?
Yeah, I just sort of went for a ball, and it was so innocuous, something that I'd done 100 times probably in the game before, and I just felt sort of something pull in my knee and go almost. And I played on for the next couple of minutes, just sort of, I don't know, bending it, trying to make sure that it was fine, and then came off, had it looked at, and both our physio and the doctor who was there for SSN looked at it, and we're all a little bit concerned. I sort of had a pretty heavy feeling in my chest, thinking, oh no, and preparing myself for what was ahead, because I've honestly just come off a 12-month rehab. I ended up going in for a scan. I was 99.9% sure that I had done my knee, and luckily that 0.1%, I got a phone call to say that my ACL was intact, but I'd given it a fair shake-up, and, I was just happy that it held on.
Well, so are we, just by the way.
Yeah. So was it the same knee as you'd done, or was it the other knee?
Yeah, same knee, which I think is why the concern was quite real. Obviously, given how much load I've put through both my legs, and every single netball player has in the last however many weeks we've been playing. It was the same knee, so I was a little bit concerned that, oh no, maybe I've pushed it a little bit too far. I've tried to play 3-4 games in a little space of time, and I think I was just immediately concerned because it was a feeling that I'd felt before, and obviously you're going to prepare yourself for the worst. I wasn't trying to go into a scan thinking, yes, I've only got 3 weeks of rehab, when I was going to come out with 12 months.
Yeah, absolutely. So take us through, Kels, when you get the phone call, the emotion, because you did such a great job in explaining to us last time when you had the full 12 months, just the emotion that you went through then. And obviously Maddie's gone through it as well. But this time around when you got the phone call and it wasn't bad news, how did you cope with that? How emotional was it?
It was probably the craziest 48 hours I've had. And it's amazing what your mind can do to convince you that you're okay. Immediately after the game, I pretty much, as I said, assumed that I'd done my ACL. So I was sitting there very process-driven, you know, what does 9 months look like from now? And I know what's ahead and I'm fine. And I'd really fully convinced myself that, yep, I can do this again. And I knew what I was in for. So I was standing in the supermarket just getting some groceries, and I got the phone call from the surgeon. I turned to Madison and I said, oh, you know, this is it, and I'm going to be fine. Like, anyway, I looked at Maddie and I shook my head. Like, I had no idea how to sort of react. He just sort of said, well, it's showing that your ACL is intact, and it just was not the news that I was expecting. So I did. I burst into tears because it was happy tears. Also, like, I don't know how I'd spent the last 24 hours preparing myself for I don't know, doomsday, and then all of a sudden to get the news that you're fine. Yeah, it was quite an emotional 48 hours, and I'm pretty emotionally exhausted now.
Yeah, no, I could imagine. And obviously you're up in the bubble. You haven't got your family around apart from your sister. But because you are in a bubble and you're in with your team, did that help in that period of unknown to support you, or is it a fairly lonely existence where you might just be staring at the ceiling, you know, wondering what's going to happen?
It's actually been amazing being in the hub, and I do believe that it fully helped me through that period of time. The only thing that I would say about that is that because you are spending so much time together, you genuinely, you've got so much care and love for your teammates that I know, you know, when Molly Jovic had her concussion, I was feeling that as much as probably she was, because you're living in such close proximity with your teammates. They're like your family at the moment. So it was a pretty somber 24 hours, I guess, while I was waiting for my scan. But it was nice to sort of have them there, talk to them about it. And I sort of moved into, okay, what else can I do for this team for the next 6 weeks? it was just nice to sort of have them there, even though, I don't know, now it's just sort of been a bit of a scare and not really much to report.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.